everybody. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. I come here really as a representative of the Integrated Medicine Project, which is, consists of these three people you see here. This is two psychiatrists and a psychologist, so it's a bit of a different crowd than what's stood in front of you so far. And what the Integrated Medicine Project is about is really a very wide-based global attempt to do our best to understand what illness is about. Bob Maunder and I are psychiatrists to see medically ill patients, and we talk to them about what it's like to be ill, what scares them about it, what impact it's had on their life, and what their beliefs are about what's contributed to their illness, as well as what factors we can elicit from their history that have potentially contributed to their illness. And that's the kind of air we breathe and the thing that make us wonder about how best to understand them. I found this quotation from a U of T grad from 1889 on his belief for what University of Toronto should be, which is a college for the promoting of physical, mathematical, experimental learning. So I feel we're carrying on a good tradition. This is a slide of the first child to be treated in an oxygen tent at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. And we always present it as a way of trying to quickly elicit the experience of being ill for people and how different it can be, how disruptive it can be to one's life, how isolating in particular it can be, and what an impact it can have. We're actually going to start, though, farther back from that, trying to understand what it is that could get somebody ill in the first place. So what are the factors that could make people sick? One of the first things people usually volunteer is that it could be germs, right? We all know that germs cause illness. So I went to my Bible of internal medicine from when I was training and found these two quotations. Human beings are not equally susceptible to the disease caused by a given bacterium or virus. And the mere presence of the organism in the body does not lead invariably to clinical illness. So there's no one-to-one correspondence between germ and illness. Well, if it isn't germs, maybe it's... Oh, one more for germs. Okay, this slide makes the... this graph makes the same point in a different way. This is a graph of the death rate from tuberculosis over the years. And what you can see is that the death rate was plummeting long before we knew what the tubercle bacillus was, and very long before we had either a drug to treat it or a way of preventing it. So there are not only factors other than the germ that impact on illness itself, there are factors other than the germ and the medical treatment that impact on health as well. I think you can probably anticipate what this was about. This was, to the best of our knowledge, was about hygiene and housing and proper aeration and ventilation and stuff like that. Well, if it's not just germs, maybe it's genes. Genes is always at the top of the list for people. But there are clearly diseases that are genetic. You can take PKU or something like that, and it's a pretty much a one-to-one correspondence. If you got the gene, you got the disease. But a doctor practicing in a general hospital is much more likely to run into this kind of stat. You look at Crohn's disease, which is an inflammatory bowel disease, and you look at concordance rate in monozygotic twins, it's only 50%. I've spent some time in a high-risk clinic for women with breast cancer, and there we see women that have BRCA1 and 2 mutations, and the BRCA2 mutation, which is a hugely significant discovery for susceptibility to cancer, in fact still does not convey 100% susceptibility to cancer. So there's a range of susceptibility here that's unaccounted for. Maybe it's gene-environment interactions. John Milton was talking about obesity, so I thought I'd show you an obesity slide. Orange is less than 10% of the population is obese. Red is greater than 15% of the population is obese. And you can see over the course of several years in Canada how the rate of obesity has gone up. Our best understanding of this is that there are genetic predispositions to obesity, particularly in Aboriginal populations. In fact, Aboriginal populations, wherever they've been studied, in Canada, in the United States, in Australia, have thrifty genes, genes that are designed to hold on to foodstuffs and calories. But there's also an increased availability of foodstuff to hold on to. There's bigger portions of higher energy-dense food. This is an enormous cost to the country, all in terms of health care and lost days. So it's a significant problem. But even all this together only explains about two-thirds of obesity, so we don't really know what the story is. Given that John Milton brought up the topic of obesity, I thought I'd try to find the equivalent map of the United States. With a little luck, I was able to find one. Got a bit of a different distribution. Economic resources. By and large, people understand it's better to be rich in all kinds of ways. Also true for health. And this kind of range has been found in, again, multiple parts of the world, multiple societies. This is from work done in England looking at how somebody's job description matches up against their all-cause mortality and the mortality from coronary heart disease. And in fact, the people at the low end of the ladder die more. Okay, you think of execs as having all that stress. Maybe they do, but they're living longer. This applies even in situations where there's universal health care, for instance, where access to health care is equivalent. So what else makes people sick? Now we're going to go a bit off the beaten path into some other areas just to sort of give you a broad, sort of sweep the flashlight across the terrain to give you some idea about what else might be out there. Is it the way doctors talk to patients? Well, it's not really what makes you sick, but it has great bearing on pain. This is a study that was done on wisdom tooth extraction, I think, a dental procedure, anyway. And the group were randomly divided up into those that received a phone call from the practitioner the day after to ask them if they were okay, and those that didn't. And they weren't to expect a call at all. Nobody knew this was going to happen. But they were, in fact, charting their pain and charting their use of pain pills. And you can see very clearly that the people that got the phone call reported less pain and used less pain pills. So this is to invoke for you the idea of relationship. Okay, where you feel connected to somebody, that by and large is something that makes you feel better, even in terms of how you report illness. Now, the area that we've been particularly interested in is whether there are impacts from, not surprisingly, two psychiatrists and a psychologist, is whether early childhood experience can impact on later illness vulnerability. And that really is the question that we're struggling with as much as anything else. And we're indebted to Folletti for the following study, which began to flesh this out for us. Folletti looked at the Kaiser Permanente database in the United States, huge numbers, N of 30,000 or something in the study, and retrospectively asked people about childhood experience. But this wasn't vague childhood experience. This was quite explicit neglect and difficulty. This was seeing your mother beaten up in the home. This was being sexually abused with very explicit criteria. So this is childhood misuse. And these are the risk factors that he asked them about. And he looked to see who, in fact, got sick. And this is what he found for lung disease. He found that as you have more childhood risk factors, you're more likely to get lung disease. Not only lung disease, but stroke, hepatitis, ischemic heart disease. Every disease he looked at had that same kind of progression, more or less. So the worse your childhood, the more likely you are to get sick as an adult. That's interesting enough to us on its own, but Folletti also checked out a couple of other things which hint at mechanism. He looked to see how those childhood risk factors correlated with things we understand as disease risks. For instance, the use of injection drugs. And sure enough, the worse your childhood, the more likely you were to inject drugs. No wonder these folks had more hepatitis, eh? Let's go back to our old favorite, obesity. The worse your childhood, the more likely you were to be obese. Therefore, the more likely you are to have diabetes, the more likely you are to have heart disease as an adult. So the suggestion here is that, in fact, there is some reason to start wondering about this. There is some data out there to suggest that what happens early on in childhood can influence who gets sick in a myriad of ways later on as an adult. That's not the whole story, though. From animal experiments in particular, we know that parenting influences physiology in a way that impacts on, or could potentially impact on, illness vulnerability. I'll give you one animal study just to illustrate the field. this refers to maternal behavior in rats, and the open circles are rats whose moms were great, and the dark circles are rats whose moms were not great. Okay? Great moms are rats that lick and groom their pups. Okay? And they're stressed, that's the black bar at the bottom, and you see that those rats, these are adult rats now, not pups anymore, you see that the rats that were stressed, that had good maternal experience early on, experienced less stress and came down on two measures of stress better than those that didn't. Pick one human study, just because the graphs are kind of similar, make the link for you. Lucan looked at college students who had lost a parent before the age of 16, and she stressed them. The standard stress in this kind of experiment is making them do what I'm doing, which is giving a speech, except they're given less chance to prepare for it. And she saw how fast they recovered. And in fact, the folks that had the loss as a child took longer to recover than the folks that didn't. So the idea here is that stress parameters might be set early and might be maintained across the lifetime. Now, the way our group understands and kind of brings this information together is by using the attachment system. So as a number of other speakers have had to give you primers on a particular field, be it electrophysiology of the heart or the hippocampus or something else, I'm going to give you a short primer on attachment so you can kind of make the link to the model I'm going to present later. Attachment is first and foremost, has to be understood as being universal in mammals. And the key points are these. All mammals are born premature. It's the price you have for having a big brain and a small birth canal. You have to get the baby out of there before it can fend for itself. That's what I mean by premature. Once it's out, of course, you have to have a way of feeding it. That's what mammary glands are for. That's why our species is called what it is. You also have to have, if you will, a psychological umbilical cord, a way of keeping that infant close to the mom, effectively trying to protect it as much as if it were still in utero. That psychological umbilical cord is the attachment system. The idea is that the baby stays close to the mom so it doesn't end up being somebody else's dinner. The first attachment is the bond between an infant and its parent. It's almost always the mother. The behavioral system, and the system's goals are simple. They're twofold. One is to keep the vulnerable infant close to the attachment figure for safety and survival. The second is the opposite, is to allow exploration once safety is established. So for the parents in the room, you know this experience. You've taken your little child to the park. They have climbed up the ladder to go sliding down the ladder. They stop at the top of the ladder and they say, "Look at me." And if they can see you, they go down the ladder, because they've got that sense of attachment and safety. If they can't see you, if you went running off after the other kids to try to find them, they will climb back down the ladder, disrupting all the other kids, rather than go down the slide, because it doesn't feel safe to them to go down the slide. There is a sense of safety that comes with that proximity to the attachment figure. So that first attachment teaches all of us expectations about the world, and behavior to enact when those expectations are met. So a security threat happens, it meets one of our expectations, we activate our behavior with and produce an attachment behavior. Over time, as that is reiterated, John Milton tells us it takes a million times to learn something, it's a million reiterations. As that is reiterated probably millions of times, people build up a pattern that is characteristic for them as individuals. And that's known in the literature as the attachment style of the individual. Okay so far? So what are the determinants of attachment style? There are determinants that belong to the parent. The usual ones that are thought of have to do with availability, responsiveness. Is this a parent who kind of knows their kid, who sort of understands that this cry is a desperate cry and this cry is a cry that's okay? That responds adequately for the message the child is giving, that kind of idea. There are also, obviously, characteristics that pertain to the child and what they are like. There are some kids that are, frankly, easier to take care of than others. They sleep more regularly, they eat more regularly, they poop more regularly. You can manage them a lot easier than you can others. Just as important as anything else, of course, has to do with the fit between those two. One parent's nightmare kid could be another parent's angel. It has to do with the matching between the parent and the child. And given what I've said about poverty, we can't rule out environmental factors either. So there's a lot of stuff that feeds in, and this is what we would expect, right? The system is made to have you adapt to your own particular ecological niche within your family. So it's programmable, and it's programmable taking into account a lot of details of what's around. Now, in order to classify adults in terms of attachment, which is what we have to do to start looking at whether or not illness is distributed around attachment categories, we need a model of adult attachment. And the most straightforward one is Kim Bartholomew's scheme. And I'm going to run you through this, and then hopefully we'll be able to run through it as a bit of a group to make sure we've got it well understood. Bartholomew said, you can classify people in terms of attachment on two simple characteristics. One is how they feel about themselves, and one is how they feel about the other person, typically the attachment figure, right? The mom, the spouse, the person they identify as the attachment figure. And you can feel good or bad about either of those things. So if you feel positive about yourself and positive about the other, then you are securely attached. This is what we all hope we are, believe we are. And that's where you have enough faith in yourself to feel that you can manage on your own, but it's also okay to go to somebody else for help because they're likely to be positive and good for you. Okay. Let's go down to this square here now. This is where somebody has not much faith in themselves and their own capacity to cope, and relatively more faith in the other person. Okay? It doesn't mean that they're so sure the other person is going to be great, but they're going to be better than they are by themselves. Okay? So what we see there is somebody who is kind of clingy. They don't like to be left alone. They stick close to you. If it's a child, they literally hold on to the mom. They don't like distance to occur. As adults, we call those folks preoccupied because they're preoccupied about the attachment. They're preoccupied about the relationship. They're often fearful. They're often kind of scared about what's going to be happening next kind of thing. And what they're doing is sending a perpetual attachment signal. They're sending a signal that says, don't leave me, I need you around all the time. We see behavior that's consistent with that. Here's the other end of the spectrum. This is somebody who's come to learn that they should rely on their own resources. Right? The model of the self is positive, and the model of the other is negative. They should rely on their own resources because the other person's good for nothing, frankly. These are kids who grew up with parents who said, whenever they were hurt, suck it up, what are you? You know? Come on. Sort of stiff upper lip, but in a kind of a demeaning way, right? So the kid learned that there was no point making an attachment signal. There's no point asking for help. You weren't going to get help, and in fact, you might get demeaned if you did it. Those folks are called dismissive. They dismiss the other people. They're kind of standalone stoic types. Okay. In the upper corner here is somebody who both has a lack of faith in their own capacity to cope and a lack of trust in the other. And we call those folks fearful. They present as pathologically shy. They just look uncomfortable, look unhappy. They don't want to engage with other people, but they're fearful on their own, and they strike people as uncomfortable to be around. Now, there is one other category, not to overdo the lingo, guys, but this square is secure. All of these three are insecure. Okay? So there's only one secure, and then there's three insecures. But everyone on the grid is organized. Okay? Everyone on the grid is reliable. If you put somebody who's preoccupied in an attachment stress, they're going to produce preoccupied behavior every time you do it. If you put somebody who's dismissive in an attachment stress, they're going to do it every time. It's organized and reliable. Okay? There is another category, which is disorganized. And these are folks who just don't have a reliable scheme. If you were to chart them kind of over time, they'd be bouncing all around these grids here. They wouldn't make it into the secure category. And these are often angry, sad, distressing folks to be around. Now, this is where I want to engage you a bit if I can. John Bowlby taught this scheme by using the following metaphor. I just want to make sure we have the categories right before we go any further. He said, John Bowlby is the founder of attachment theory, excuse me. He said, there's a barking dog, and there's an isolated baby, and there's a mom on the other side of the barking dog. What's the child supposed to do? Suggestions.
Cry.
Stay there and cry? Okay. So if the child stays there and cries, what do you think their attachment style is? Secure, right. Bowlby would say they're secure. They have enough faith in themselves to stay there, and they have enough faith in the mom that she'll come if she hears the cry. So staying there and crying is a secure pattern of behavior. What other options the kid could have? Go over and meet mother. Now, there's two ways of meeting mother. One is like this. Is that what you meant?
Yeah, go
okay. That's secure too, right?
Yeah.
That's, I called for mom. She can't come, but she's a good mom, so there must be something holding her up. You know, I'm a tough little guy. I'll see what I can do, and I'll try to get to her and kind of meet her halfway. And the odds are good that mom will come and meet me halfway here. So that's a second secure pattern. All right? The other way of meeting mom is going like this, right? That's not a good strategy, right? It takes her right past the threatening dog. And that's preoccupied. That's, I don't have enough faith in myself. I have to get to mom. I can't process anything else. I'm going. And they go that way. So you can see that preoccupied is a pattern that is going to be less successful in the long run, but still nevertheless one that occurs in nature. One other? Two other?
Runs away,
right? Runs this way. Dog's bad news. Mom's no freaking good to me. I'm hitting the brick, right? That's a dismissive kid, okay? So that's secure, preoccupied, and dismissive. Now, for all you lateral thinkers in the audience, what's the last one?
Tame the dog.
Tame the dog? No, the dog is too threatening to tame. The dog is a universal threat.
Bite the dog.
Bite him. All right. All right, well, there's another situation, which is what tells us about disorganized attachment, and that is when your mother is the dog. Okay? That's when, it's not funny, that's when the same person that you should be going to, that you're biologically keyed to go to for comfort, is as likely to hit you as to feed you. Okay? That's when you go, and sometimes it's okay to be there, and you might get cuddled, and sometimes you might get molested. Okay, so that's disorganized. And these kids don't have a safe haven in the world. They literally don't have a safe haven. They grow up as adults without a safe haven. And when you see a kid like that, they're really very distressing. Nobody can see a kid like that and not be distressed. They have approach and avoidance. They have help-seeking, help-rejecting behavior, that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's all background, really. The attachment system, therefore, uses two basic rules to generate a wide range of behavior. And this is really one of the first places where I started to wonder about potential help from mathematicians, because it felt to me like it might be kind of one of those, climatology things where a couple of things go and then one day you get rain and the next day you get something else, depending on how you run the simulation. It also, importantly, from the point of view of illness vulnerability, it calibrates the physiological stress response. It tells you what danger is, it tells you what safety is, and it cues up your hypothalamic pituitary axis in such a way as to respond to those safety and danger signals. Now, there's evidence for attachment being relevant to illness in both the animal, pediatric, and adult literature. For the sake of time, I'm going to give you two quick glimpses at the adult literature so that we don't get bogged down in the data. This is Bob Maunder's data from our group. He looked at ulcerative colitis patients. He looked at two groups. He looked at people that were ANCA positive. ANCA positivity is a marker for more genetic contribution to the ulcerative colitis. They're understood to have a higher genetic loading for ulcerative colitis, whereas ANCA negatives don't have as much. Okay? So everybody's got ulcerative colitis, but you have one group that's got more genetic contribution and one group that has less. Bob's hypothesis was that if you got the genetic loading, you're probably going to get sick. right? Probably doesn't need a whole bunch of other stuff to get in there. If you have less genetic loading, it may be that issues like attachment style and other stressors could contribute to the illness onset. And in fact, what he found out was that there was a higher than expected incidence of avoidant attachment in the ANCA negative group. This is Paul Tichanowski's work on diabetics, which doesn't perhaps speak to how people get diabetes, but it perhaps speaks very loudly to how people get complications from diabetes. He took diabetics, attachment subtyped them, and then asked them a second question. He said, can you talk to your doc? What's your communication like with your doctor, the diabetes doctor? And he divides that up into good and bad. These three groups are statistically identical. There's no difference here. If you look at the dismissive category, though, that's the kid who's running this way off the board, going to do things by themselves. If they can talk to their doctor, they're okay. If they can't talk to their doctor, then their hemoglobin A1C, this is a measure of their glucose control, is terrible. And this range is high enough that this group is more likely to develop microvascular complications sooner. So this is the group that's going to get blind first. This is the group that's going to get kidney disease first. This is the group that's going to get impotent first. Okay, their fingers are going to fall off. This is trouble, this range. And it comes from a dismissive style coupled with poor communication with the doctor. So again, attachment having a relevance to how people manage illness. Lots of talk on Monday, about health costs. And here you see the attachment bears on health costs as well. Preoccupied patients come to the doctor more. They probably precipitate more tests because they tend to come with vaguer complaints and yet be desperate. So you're not quite sure what's going on, but the patient's very distressed, so you do more for them. It costs the system more. These two are actually statistically the same. And the fearful patients are staying away. They don't want to come to see anybody. They're keeping in the background. So this is the model that we published to suggest that insecure attachment was relevant to disease. And it has really three main arms. The top arm here has to do with stress physiology. If you're insecurely attached, you're going to perceive more stress. The odds are, based on that childhood experience we talked about, that you're going to have impaired regulation of stress physiology, and you're going to be less able to use somebody else to help you calm yourself down. So there'll be decreased social modulation of stress, and that changes your physiological stress response, which may be a contribution to disease vulnerability. This, incidentally, is built up from the literature, some of which I've quoted to you, and some data that we're accumulating, but should be understood as theoretical, really, at this point in time. The second line takes us back to Folletti. If you have insecure attachment, you have swings of emotion that are harder for you to control. People that have swings of emotion are hard to control want to control their emotion, and they will typically turn to an external regulator of emotion, particularly distress, as soon as they can. All the external regulators of emotion are disease risk variables, right? They're alcohol, they're tobacco, they're overeating, they're having too much sex unwisely. All of those things can contribute to illness. And the last one has to do with altered use of protective factors. Maybe keep the dismissive individual in mind when you think of this. If you're insecurely attached and you don't feel that well, you may not, in fact, even pay attention to the symptom. If you do, it's going to be hard for you to go to the doctor, hard for you to go to somebody else because you may not have a significant other. And your treatment adherence may well be like that diabetic cohort that I told you about, and they may not adhere well at all. So that's going to take you in the route of increasing disease. Sorry. So that's the model as we publish it. Now, I was thinking as I was putting this together, not least of all because of my attendance here, that I think we missed the boat on something. And I wonder if, in fact, this isn't closer to what is likely to be true. And all I've done here is put double-headed arrows on everything. Because I think probably, in truth, the system can reverberate. You can imagine a situation where somebody has an increase in their stress response. They go to use an external regulator of affect, which may be risky sexual behavior. That reduces their social support, and the thing cycles around and cycles around and cycles around before it comes out to disease. So that's the idea we're left with. There is some, incidentally, some data on childhood disease contributing to insecure attachment, although it's not a very straightforward story. Speak to that if you want me to later. We certainly see adults with illness whose experience in the hospital exacerbates and brings out their insecure attachment quite markedly. So that's the model that we have, and that really I wanted to present to you in terms of your help in understanding it, see if anybody has any ideas to help us work our way through that. The problem, stated another way, is that illness vulnerability consists of multiple factors that are interacting with varying degrees of influence over varying time periods with each other, on the individual's exposure to illness-causing agents, on the responsiveness to that agent, on how effectively they utilize health care, how effectively they utilize other helpful relationships to deal with that illness. So this is what you feel like as a clinician, except you don't have 5 balls, you have about 12 balls you're trying to keep in the air all the same time. So the problem that we confront is whether we should do what all good hospital-based clinician researchers do, and that is to just plow through this in a linear way, you know, sort of take insecure attachment and risky sexual behavior and disease, and should we find links there? And certainly we're trying to do that. We've had talks with our HIV clinic to see if we can find links there. That top bar, we have an investigation going for in another way. And we're doing that. We're doing our best at that, try to fill in some of the numbers. But that's sort of like searching for the next virus or the next cytokine or the next gene that's going to make all the difference. And you see this in the news every day, right? And I'm skeptical about whether that will ever give us the big picture. I wonder if there's a way that we can analyze or explore the relative contributions of these factors in order to increase our understanding and hopefully eventually guide us in the development of interventions. And this is the premise we're working on. The premise is that evolution has selected interactive mechanisms with high redundancy for the maintenance of health in the face of a varying and unpredictable environment. We're all the product of our evolutionary lineage, and that's a lineage that has selected us all for being able to cope with change. The highest evolutionary value comes with flexibility and redundancy. And I'm suggesting that we have that, and that illness then, illness vulnerability, is an emergent event that represents one outcome or state of that complex system. The links I would suggest a little bit loosely that make us think of this kind of connection is that there are similarities to thinking about people in this way with other systems that have demonstrated nonlinearity, ecosystems, economics, climatological models, that the outcome, whether it be illness or health, may be tracked backwards but not reliably predicted. That more is different. When you throw in more variables, you get a nonlinear relationship, at least from an unsophisticated point of view, it appears to get very complicated very quickly. And we end up with this kind of picture where we have a set of variables that we think are relevant to illness vulnerability, and inside each one of those, we can find more sets of variables, and each one of those, we can find more sets of illness vulnerables. So you have this kind of tunnel of mirrors effect when you try to analyze the problem. It also strikes me that each of the things we think of subsets for our big set has been modeled as a complex system, or at least a number of them have. We've seen some talks on this here. The brain, which is, of course, I haven't spoken about it explicitly, but the brain is the organ that's modulating all this stuff. The brain is understood to be, modeled as a neural network. Immunity was described as a self-learning pattern recognition device. And when you see a diagram, and this is a simple one, of the immune system, you quite quickly get the sense that it must be a complex system due to the multiple levels of hierarchy and interactions. And in fact, both society in terms of and economics in terms of that stuff around economics and socioeconomic status impact on health also are relevant there. So the question is, if each level is complex and the metasystem is complex, could this be a fractal phenomenon? And if it is, what's the set of underlying rules for the generation of the phenomenon? Now, in my naivete, I wonder about several potential levels of analysis. The most straightforward would be, how do we figure out what the late manifestation of an early influence is? The attachment stuff I'm talking about is pretty much set before you're 18 months old. And we're talking about illness that's happening to somebody when they're 50 or 60. Is there any way we can really form any kind of connection between that? We know that that attachment experience might happen at 18 months, but it is in fact present, the derivative of it is present in the 60-year-old as well. Can we look at that big table of interlocking squares and find some way of analyzing that that's useful? Or can we in fact incorporate that into a more complex system that involves some of the other issues we haven't talked about, treatment, society, economic status? And is it best to do that in terms of an analysis, or is it best to do that in terms of a simulation? Seeing as I've been trying to have a conversation with a mathematician for about 4 years, I'm grabbing my moment in the sun to suggest a couple of other things. And that's other things we see that I think might be viable projects. That includes phantom limb sensation and pain, other chronic pain mechanisms, which are probably easily modeled as changes to neural networks. The therapeutic mechanism of ECT. ECT remains our most effective antidepressant, and nobody knows why it works. But we know that you can look at EEGs and find chaotic variables in them, and nobody's looked at EEGs pre and post ECT to see if the chaotic variables change. It'd be an interesting study to do. And there is a bit of work in cyclical mood disorders. So, Brian Arthur said, when you mathematize something, you distill its essence. I'd be delighted to get whatever essence we could out of this from you guys. I appreciate the chance to present to you. I don't know if you can help me, but when I found out that you can, in fact, help cartoonists, I was encouraged. Thank you.